Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, and in this week's programme we have an interview with a writer who found a whole world of fascinating history in a tiny corner of North Yorkshire. We'll be looking at all the wheels and deals of this year's Frankfurt Book Fair. There'll be highlights from the latest Guardian Book Club discussion with the author of the best-selling novel Half of a Yellow Sun, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, and we will be sailing off through night and day and in and out of weeks and almost over a year to Where the Wild Things Are in 2009. Where the Wild Things Are in a new film version by Dave Eggers and Spike Jones. But first, Madeleine Bunting's book The Plot is subtitled The Biography of an Acre. It was an acre of North Yorkshire that her sculptor father bought shortly after the Second World War, a place that came replete with its own wild things.
For as long as I could remember, we had shared this piece of land with a family of adders. As small children, we accompanied each other cautiously down the path to a spot in the bank which always caught the sun. Here, above the wall, on a smooth bed of pine needles, an adder would usually be coiled, lazily absorbing the heat of the sun. His dramatic patterning rippled over the folds of reptilian skin. The brilliant, tawny yellow scales glinted in the sun. We thrilled at the possibility of danger, we delighted in our bravery, and we always tiptoed away as quietly as we had arrived. The adder had a definite article, like the chapel, the hut, and the track. Such was its centrality in our lives. Once, when a monk borrowed the hut for a fortnight's retreat, he reported that the adder came to bask on the stone doorstep, effectively trapping him inside. But the monk was unperturbed. He seemed to understand, as we did, that we shared this plot with another family, whose discreet comings and goings we only glimpsed, and who, during the long periods we were not there, reclaimed the run, if one can use such a word of snakes, of the place. But on this particular August afternoon, the adder was not in its usual place. It was on a section of the track at the entrance to the plot, where the turf is smooth and has a slightly hollow ring when stamped. Our dog, Fan, got agitated. For a brief moment, there was fear and need to protect, but it passed and the dog was on the lead. We could have walked quickly away, but my father had a spade and he raised it. The snake, electrified by the danger, was transformed from the sleepy sunbather of our acquaintance and launched it into a spellbinding performance. Its body was flexed, its head a foot off the ground, its tongue lashing in and out, hissing with fury. The dog was in near apoplexy as it tugged furiously on the lead, and my father, were his eyes round and popping as they always were when angry, brought the spade down on the writhing body, again and again and again. I watched, horrified yet unwittingly fascinated. Finally it lay limp, pathetic, no more than a piece of waste to be tossed into the undergrowth. A beautiful, dignified creature, whose species had happily coexisted with us for 2 decades, was dead.
Madeleine Bunting reading from The Plot, an ambitious attempt to funnel the history of the UK and its people through its particular impact on a single acre of land in North Yorkshire. Welcome, Madeleine.
Thank you.
Now, that was a rather brutal introduction to your father. Tell us a bit about him. It is, in a way, a tribute to him, isn't it, this book?
The book is a tribute, but honesty is always, I think, absolutely essential as a writer. So I've not tried to write a hagiography. He was a very difficult, conflicted man, and I don't think he resolved many of the conflicts that produced such frustration in him. He was dedicated to sculpting. That was his craft. He found it at a precociously early age of 10 or 11. He'd already conceived this ambition to be a sculptor, which horrified his parents from sort of, you know, respectable business backgrounds. But he carried on carving until within a few months of his death at the age of 75. He never stopped.
He wasn't from Yorkshire, was he?
No, he was born and brought up in Barnet, in suburban Barnet, which at that time in the 1930s was part of this extraordinary expansion of suburban London. In fact, the population of London has never exceeded that of 1939. And I think there was many ways in which he felt that suburban Barnet, almost in a sort of George Orwell, you know, has written about that kind of expansion. He felt it was soulless, that it lacked all integrity, all authenticity. And it was just evidence of a kind of corrupt, decadent civilization. And he headed off to the wilds, which in those days North Yorkshire was.
And how did he come across this particular little bit of land? It's in the middle of nowhere, really, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, he was evacuated from London as a teenager when the bombs were dropping and sent to the safety of the school Ampleforth. And there's a tradition that all the boys are kind of emptied out of the school so that they can clean the place properly once a year in the summer. And so my father was rambling across these hillsides as a teenager. He was just short of his 17th birthday. And he came to what would have been the ruins of an old small holding that had been abandoned about 60 years before. And I think that there was something about him arriving on that little scrap of land. And the day, because it was in fact D-Day in June 1944, and it was this sort of intersection of time and place that meant that the place lodged in his memory, and 12 years later he came back and leased that acre of land from the Forestry Commission and built his chapel there.
Now, it, as well as being a biography of your and tribute to your father, you delve quite deeply into the what one might call psychogeography with a bow and a scrape to Ian Sinclair. Tell us about how you came to structure the book.
I was very influenced by Ian Sinclair. I love the way he digs. You know, he's an archaeologist of memory, really. And I was also very influenced by Kathleen Jamie, who I think has a wonderful sort of elegance about the way she knits together the sort of mundane and the extraordinary. And the kind of landscapes we live in England are very kind of mixed up with the mundane. I did not want to write a picturesque book. You know, I stand on top of the North Yorkshire Moors and let's be absolutely blunt about it. I can see the chimneys of Teesside.
And there's quite a lot of shit in it.
Absolutely. You know, if you ask me what is the distinctive smell of the North Yorkshire Moors, it's sheep shit.
You have a whole chapter on sheep, in fact.
I know. It's been a great kind of sort of source of amusement. Do you like the sheep or don't you like the sheep? I've converted a lot of people into liking sheep. I think sheep have been much underestimated.
But and their importance, interestingly, is not for their meat, principally, in your argument.
Well, the amazing thing is it's actually a really recent thing, the sort of meat side of sheep. By and large, they've been used for wool and leather and fat. The value of a sheep was really in its fat for candles, tallow type candles, than it was for meat. Until really recently, we didn't really eat much meat. Maybe the last 100 years we started eating sheep. But if you look back over thousands of years in which sheep have been the most consistent companion to human beings, we've used them for everything. Musical instruments, footwear, bags, string. I mean, you think of what human beings need and sheep one way or another have provided for it.
So now, coming back to the actual plot again, Scotch Corner, it did unwittingly play a part in quite a few historical dramas, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty nondescript little acre of land. Lots of people could walk right across it and not sort of really notice they've ever been there. The chapel my father built is a very modest building, looks a bit like a farm barn or something. But what I really like is that beneath all this kind of anonymity of the place, it's actually been involved in one way or another with some really, really sort of extraordinarily momentous sort of events. I mean, one of them, of course, is the Battle of Byland, a massive defeat for the English when the Scots trounced the English. And not surprisingly, it's not in our history books.
But it is on the internet, isn't it?
Yes, it is most definitely on the internet, because the Scots Nats, nationalists, you know, I really like remembering the Battle of Byland. You know, it's a great moment in their history, along with Bannockburn. And what I love is the fact that the Scottish nationalists have looked at my father's chapel and have decided it's a memorial to the Scots.
Of course, it's on Scotch Corner. What else could it be?
Exactly.
There's a bigger history, isn't there, of cattle droving?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing, is that across the acre, there's this ancient path, probably Mesolithic or maybe even earlier. So it's been a thoroughfare for several thousand years, and most significantly, from about the sort of, you know, Middle Ages, sort of 1400 to 1900s, it was being used as a drover's track to drive cattle down from Scotland down to the meat markets of southern England eventually. And, you know, you think, well, this was crucial to the expansion of Britain as an imperial nation, because you can't feed a navy with the salt beef that keeps them fighting without having a very well organised livestock industry in the UK. So Scotland produced the meat, drove it down to London, and it then got made into salt beef and ensured that Britain could send its navy across the seas to conquer the world. You know, these kinds of global connections, I think, are absolutely fascinating. And, you know, the acre plays its humble part in that.
And of course, there are connections that continue into the 20th century. You have one farmer, local farmer, complaining that it's nowt but views. I can't do the accent, I have to warn you.
Well, it's a famous thing about Yorkshiremen. I mean, they love their county with a passion. I mean, they describe it as God's own country. On the other hand, they're very self-deprecating about it. So, you know, nowt but views is a kind of classic Yorkshireman type saying, because it's a very gentle, undramatic sort of landscape. You know, you get layer upon layer of quite sort of flat horizons. There's no dramatic mountains or anything, but you do get this extraordinary sense of space.
And but you also have a people who've had very hard times, really. It was an idyll for your father, but not for the farmer living down the road.
No, I mean, the plot is just inside the National Park boundary, the North Yorks National Park boundary. And it's a landscape which looks very beautiful. Everybody loves it. Everybody loves visiting as tourists. But it's extremely difficult to farm. You know, it's got a very, very kind of complicated topography, which means modern tractors and so forth can't get down the tracks, can't squeeze into the small fields, can't plough. So what kind of farming can you do there? It's all very, very small scale. And when I talked to one particular local family who had done, a retired farmer, had done these wonderful family histories, he'd gone back through his family account books. And for generations, the farming has been hard there. It's been very hard for a long time. In fact, you know, agricultural depressions of the 20th century and the 19th century had pretty much bankrupted the family several times. So the story of farmers now, which is of decline and retreat, a lot of the farmhouses have been sold for weekend cottages. A lot of the farms are not really functioning anymore. You know, it's coming after 200 years of struggle. Mm. Which is a pretty poignant story, really.
Mm. So there is a lot of reportage in this. You've actually gone round and talked to a lot of local people. But there's also a meditation on what identity is today. What does this book have to say to us about our identity?
Well, I think it says it doesn't have a sort of, you know, it's not hitting you over the head with a kind of clear conclusion. I think what it's asking you to do, it's sort of inviting you into a conversation, which is, how do we construct the narratives that give us identity? How do we use history to tell us who we are and where we are, you know? And it seems to me that, you know, there's a real kind of set of questions here about where do we call home? Where do we feel we belong? And you know, what exactly does that consist of? So for me, there's a very personal story here. I grew up for 16 years in Yorkshire. I've lived in London for 25 years. Am I a Yorkshire woman or am I a Londoner? And I think lots and lots of other people are in that same sort of situation of having moved across lots of different parts of the UK and indeed the globe. And so what I'm saying here is be imaginative, be creative, use that geography of your own lives to create your own story of identity. The only thing we need is imagination, and we can find sort of common stories together, providing that we are imaginative enough.
So this is very much a story for people of all over the world, not just from Yorkshire. Thank you very much for joining us today, Madeline. The Plot is published by Granta and is available from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. The Frankfurt Book Fair is the engine of the literary year all over the world. This year's special guest was China, which caused an international rumpus when the Chinese government insisted that two writers were struck off from a panel of a keynote debate. With me in the studio to discuss this and other incidents at Frankfurt are Sarah Crown, editor of The Guardian's books website, and Nicholas Klee, formerly editor of the trade Bible, The Bookseller, and now founder of Book Brunch, a daily email service which is becoming a must for publishing insiders. Nick, you've also just been shortlisted for the Sports Book of the Year, I gather. Did it go through Frankfurt? Have you sold rights all around the world?
No, I haven't. So rights still available. Let's advertise that.
Sarah, tell us a bit about this storm. Was it a good idea to have China as the main guest of the fair?
Well, you can see why they did it, because it's been, China is really in the news at the moment. It's becoming a bigger and bigger power in the world. They host the Olympics and everyone's feeling fairly kind of interested in what they're up to. So you can absolutely see why they thought it was a good idea. But what they ended up doing was putting themselves in the middle of a quite thorny political debate. So I guess, you know, kind of ultimately they probably decided it wasn't. And so basically what happened was the Chinese government threatened to pull out of this key debate that was sort of central to the programme if these two distant authors were allowed to be present. So Frankfurt ended up being in the position of having to make a call on it and decided to say no, they couldn't come. One of the authors turned up anyway as sort of through pen as an uninvited guest and gave interviews. And then that was all anyone was talking about. So I expect, yes, in the end, they got their hands burnt. But then Frankfurt's famous for this kind of controversy. Anyway, last year was Turkey and Orhan Pamuk talking about the political situation there. Then the year before, it was Catalonia was their special guest. And then they had Spanish authors boycotting it because only Catalan authors were originally allowed to talk. And so it's, yeah.
Nicholas, what does it mean in being invited as a special guest?
Well, it means you get to stage hundreds of events to showcase your book at the largest book fair in the world, potentially to sell a lot more rights in your books.
Does it work, do you think?
Countries lobby to be guest of honour. They want to be. They try to take full advantage of it. So, yes, I suppose it does. I mean, Frankfurt is so vast that when you're there as a reporter, you tend to concentrate on your own little corner of events. So I must admit that rarely when I go to Frankfurt does what goes on among the in the stands belonging to the countries of honour make much of an impression on me, or in the special pavilion they have.
Can you, for those of us who have never been, describe what it's like? How big is it?
There are 8 aircraft hangar type halls at Frankfurt, and to get from one end of the fairground to another probably takes about half an hour to walk. You have buses to ferry from one end to the other. You have to be a bit blinkered and concentrate on what you are there to do, because otherwise you would just get overwhelmed by it all.
As a journalist, what do you do? I mean, are there lots of whispering conversations going on that you're not allowed to be part of?
Oh, well, I wish there were. It's getting very staid, really, these days. There isn't... One talks about the Frankfurt buzz, but in fact there isn't really a great deal of buzz about the fair anymore. It's sort of quiet and business-like. That's the headline we tend to write every year. I mean, I don't want to downgrade the book fair for that reason. I suppose if we call ourselves literary journalists, we tend to concentrate on what the big publishers, the mainstream publishers, are doing on the big fiction and non-fiction. But that's not really what Frankfurt is about these days. It's about lots of companies doing rather unexciting but vital deals to do with distribution in the Far East or selling picture book rights in France, that sort of thing.
So tell me, what is exciting to report about? You must have found something that got your blood going.
Well, there are a few things. They often tend to be not to do with Frankfurt at all. For instance, there's lots of talk about Google Books this year, and that's a very interesting debate. The one book that I suppose it was of international interest at Frankfurt this year and did get people excited was Nelson Mandela's Diaries, which Macmillan has bought and will be published next year, and publishers all around the world bid for those.
Sarah, did you pick up any? We obviously carried bits and pieces on the website.
Well, the Nelson Mandela book was certainly the most exciting. The other one that caught our interest on the desk was David Mitchell, the comedian rather than the author, who's going to be writing a novel. So that certainly piqued people's interests, I think.
This year, Frankfurt, next year, the world. Nicholas, thank you very much for joining us. And you can look at Book Brunch on bookbrunch.co.uk. This Saturday, John Mullen continues his Guardian Book Club column looking at one of the decade's best-selling novels, Half of a Yellow Sun. Its author, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, dropped into the club recently to discuss with some of her many fans the issues raised by her harrowing tale of the Nigerian Civil War.
Now, I am actually very, really thrilled that I'm widely read in Nigeria. I have people walk up to me all the time, particularly about Purple Hibiscus, to lecture me about how they didn't like the ending, this is what you should have done, and, you know, I get this all the time. I think Half of a Yellow Sun, because of the subject, I can see that people, particularly people who are not Igbo, whose personal experiences don't sort of include Biafra. I mean, there are people who have said to me, who don't want to read the book because of the subject, right? Who sort of have preconceived ideas of what the book is just because they hear it's about Biafra, and who often are quite ignorant about Biafra as well. So that's there, and I know that it's there. But I think in general, and again, it cuts across ethnic lines in Nigeria, that Half of a Yellow Sun has been really well received and has often been a starting point for people to have conversations about our history. I think that Nigerians, particularly Nigerians of my generation, our generation, just don't know very much about, you know, we know very little about our recent history. We know very little about our history, period. And it's something that has always bothered me. And one of the hopes that I had when I was working on this book, apart from wanting to apart from this book being about my grandfathers, really, it was also about hoping that my generation of Nigerians would start to talk about our history, that this would be a starting point, that people would read this and then go on to read more and ask questions. And for me, it's really very gratifying to hear back from people who say, you know, until I read your book, I had no idea. And now I'm asking my parents what happened to them and what they knew and what they went through. And now I'm going to go read this other book and that sort of thing. And for me, it's very gratifying. It was what I hoped would happen. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done. I have many other problems with our education system, so I probably should stop before I go into a rant. But
Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie speaking at the Guardian Book Club. And you can hear more of the discussion from the event in the Book Club podcast. It's at guardian.co.uk/books. Now, Dave Eggers showed no false modesty when he made his debut in 2000 with a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. He made the shortlist for that year's Guardian First Book Prize, but fell at the last because, if I remember correctly, no one quite knew how to take his brattish self-promotion. In the decades since, he's blown like a whirlwind through the literary world as editor of the influential literary, what do we call it, a salon, magazine,
journal,
McSweeney's, author of a series of books, and now adapter of Maurice Sendak's classic picture books, Where the Wild Things Are. With us to discuss him is Guardian film writer Zan Brooks and, of course, Sarah Crown. But first, I've set Sarah and Zan a challenge to read the opening few lines of both versions. Zan, would you read first from the original?
The night Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind and another, his mother called him Wild Thing, and Max said, I'll eat you up. So he was sent to bed without eating anything.
Sarah, now Dave Eggers' version.
Matching Stumpy pant for pant, Max chased his cloud-white dog through the upstairs hallway, down the wooden stairs and into the cold, open foyer. Max and Stumpy did this often, running and wrestling through the house, though Max's mother and sister, the two other occupants of the home, didn't appreciate the volume and violence of the game. Max's dad lived in the city and phoned on Wednesdays and Sundays, but sometimes did not.
Zan, what's with the dog?
Well, I guess it's an extrapolation, isn't it? It's the dog that appears just in one panel of the original Sendak book now gets far more of a starring role. And, you know, this is probably the only way that Dave Eggers could have gone with this. This is the original Sendak book runs to, I think, 10 sentences in total. So although these 10 sentences have become a kind of magic incantation for children for the last 40 years, it provides not a whole lot in terms of a screenplay and a novelisation. So you've then got to build from there, I think.
Mm. Let's just stick with the original to start with. You have a small child. Do you read The Wild Things?
Yes, I have. I have to say, it's one of those books that I remember incredibly fondly from my own childhood as one of the great texts. It doesn't resonate quite so much with my daughter. I'm not quite sure why. Possibly because Max is a boy and she tends to gravitate towards...
Daughter?
She's just turned five. Mm. She tends to gravitate towards little girls. Maybe it's that the illustrations are strange and muted and almost minor key, and perhaps she prefers something a bit more day-glow and colourful.
Mm. Nicholas, what did you? Your children are a bit older. Did you read it with them?
Yes, I did. Of course, I haven't read Eggers's book, but one can't help but be sceptical in advance of reading it because it's precisely the concision of Sendak's text and the pictures that appeals. One doesn't want that fleshed out.
Mm. Now, Sarah, that tiny little dog detail seems to sum up the essential difference between picture book and a novel. I'm particularly troubled by the word novelisation. It's a horrible word, isn't it? What does it actually mean?
Well, I think that in this instance, it means one person's version of all the possible stories that the picture book gestures at. But a picture book is inclusive, whereas a novel is exclusive. You can, with a picture book, there are many, many suggested stories. You know, it could all be about the dog that you see flashing past, or it could be about the fact that Max draws pictures, which, you know, you see one of those up on the wall. And there are loads of possibilities generated by the pictures. But a novel is exclusive, and it once you start laying down words, then you reduce the number of possibilities that the pictures suggest. Max in the picture book is Maurice Sendak's Max, and has a lot to do with Sendak when he was a child. And the Max in the film version has a lot to do with Spike Jones, and it's Spike Jones's Max. And this is his Max. It's Dave Eggers's Max. And so it's his version of what the picture book gave to him. And one thing that he also says, and has said in interviews as well, is that he found the book absolutely terrifying when he was a kid. He had to have it taken out of his room. He couldn't sleep with it there. And he says it took him until his 20s to kind of get to grips with how he felt about it. Mm. And, I think that definitely comes through in the novel.
Now, reviewing the novel in the Guardian Saturday Review this week, Patrick Ness said that although Eggers does a fine job portraying the chaotic existence of a very young boy, as well as the innumerable stresses that the rest of the world places on him without even thinking, the form ultimately limited the imagination of the reader and merely sent him back to the original. Do you feel it works as a piece of work in its own right?
I really came to it very sceptically, like Nicholas, and I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. The story goes that Sendak originally intended it to be a fairy tale in which the psychological journey that we go through in the fairy tale normally becomes explicit, becomes the text rather than the subtext. So Max's journey into the forest is supposed to be clearly Max's journey inside his own head. Mm. And Eggers plays with this in the novel and does it just absolutely perfectly. So you can read it horizontally or vertically as a straight fantasy in which he goes off and finds monsters on an island. Or you can read it just as interestingly, probably I think more interestingly, as Max going inside his own head and dealing with the way that he feels about himself and his sister and his mum and his parents' divorce.
We ran a piece about Maurice Sendak on the website, and we got a fantastic response, didn't we, from bloggers. I mean, a lot of people feel they own this story.
It was sort of spinning off an interview that Sendak did with Newsweek in the States. And there's been a bit of chatter about some parents think maybe the film's too scary for their children, and it all sounds fairly manufactured to me. But the interviewer put this question to Sendak, and he said, "I would tell them to go to hell." And then he said, "And if the kids can't handle it, they should go home or wet their pants," which was fairly abrasive response. But the interesting thing is that overwhelmingly, in fact, absolutely without exception, everyone who came to comment on the story, everyone said, "Yes, it's absolute nonsense. Children like to be scared, or it's important to be scared, or it's not that scary." It would be, they were all backing Sendak.
Mm-hmm. Now, Zan, the film's just opened in the US, where it took $32.5 million in the first weekend, I gather. When does it arrive here?
It arrives here at Christmas. It's a Christmas film. It's a sad, depressive Christmas film that's disguised itself as a kids' movie, I think. And one of the interesting things about that opening weekend take was that apparently only one-third of the audience was adults bringing a child. So it is nominally a children's film, but it's really not. It's a film about children and about the journey that the child goes through to reach, if not adulthood, then maybe adolescence. Mm.
So describe it. How have they done the monsters?
It's all live action. It's what is known in that wonderfully vague term, a troubled production. This was actually shot something like 3 years ago. It was originally with one studio, Universal, who hated what Spike Jones was doing with the story so much that Spike Jones then had to shop it around, and then it went to Warner Brothers. When Spike Jones finished filming it, Warner Brothers had a look at it and were at one stage apparently prepared to stump up another $75 million to have him shoot the whole thing again. They were, I think, wanting a wild, wacky, Jim Carrey-style romp. And what they've got is, I think, a very maudlin, melancholic story of a sad little boy who voyages to a magical island and meets sad little monsters, mm-hmm. And then makes peace with his mother.
They're quite big monsters, aren't they?
They are big monsters, and so much so that I think apparently their heads were too big for the actors.
Obviously, whatever purists make of the result, Dave Eggers is going to be everywhere this Christmas. Next month, McSweeney's brings out an anthology of short stories to mark its 10th anniversary. Sarah, could you tell us what McSweeney's is? This is the other great Eggers enterprise.
Yes, its full name is Timothy McSweeney's Quarterly Concern, and it's a literary journal edited by Eggers with pieces written by the likes of Zadie Smith and Roddy Doyle, Wells Tower, Joyce Carol Oates. But it's an exercise in form as much as one of content. Every issue is published in a different way. So it's been pamphlets in a box, it's been made up to look like a handful of junk flyers, a piece of origami, something that you have to unfold. And Nick Hornby has written the introduction for this 10 years United States of McSweeney anthology. And I couldn't quite believe it when I was reading it, because he says, what with the tricky cellophane bags and the origami folding, I hadn't actually read many of the actual stories themselves. And he's a contributor. So I think the anthology is designed to give fans of the journal a version of the journal that they actually want to read.
Now, Zan, you've had a bit of a sneak preview of the anthology. It's beautifully produced, isn't it?
Yes, I love short stories anyway, so I'm predisposed to like McSweeney's. I like the Wells Tower story because I think Wells Tower's, his anthology earlier this year, Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned, was one of my favourite books of the year. I can't quite get over the cliqueyness of it, though. I think that does irritate me a little bit. Mm. It's almost like the sort of the liberal Kennedy White House, that it's a very exclusive club. And my one trepidation about Where the Wild Things Are movie is that the last movie that Eggers wrote was Away We Go, the Sam Mendes film that he wrote, co-wrote with his wife Venda Levida, which was the ultimate cliquey movie. It really was the sense that you were just supposed to kind of look on these characters who are thinly veiled versions of Eggers and Vida themselves, I felt, and admire them and just think, you know, why aren't all Americans like these slightly kooky, wacky, inclusive people who are actually incredibly exclusive?
Mm. Now, I always think of Eggers a bit as the Damien Hirst of the literary world. He's a sort of wizard who has all the best ideas and lots of people to put them into practice for him.
Yeah, I think so. It's a sort of P.T. Barnum kind of quality to him.
Now, you're going to want to have your say about this, I hope. Mm. So do please visit guardian.co.uk/books. The United States of McSweeney's is out on November the 5th from Hamish Hamilton. And look out for a reading of one of the short stories from it, also on guardian.co.uk/books. And that's it for this week's podcast. Thank you to our guests, Nicholas Klee, Zan Brooks and Sarah Crown. If you want to have your say on any of the topics we've discussed, you can do so on guardian.co.uk/books. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Scott Corley.